everybody. I'm Natalie Strickland, and I'm an alcoholic. First of all, I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me to open up this weekend of caring and sharing. I'm happy to be here. I was here at the first one, and for many, many after that. And I know y'all are going to have a wonderful time. And for those of you who have heard my story, the first part has not changed. For those of you who haven't heard my story, hold on to your seat, because I tell it like it is. In fact, my first talk was when I was 6 weeks dry in this program, and the speaker didn't show up at a meeting, and they said, "You're it." And I didn't know anything about giving my talk in a general way about what... In effect, I did my fifth step. And there was a heavyset Al-Anon sitting in the front row who kept going, And that's where my reputation for telling it like it is started. I also was not asked to speak for a year and a half. I have some other funny stories about coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, but I ought to give you the reason I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I could say truthfully that it was a miracle. I feel very blessed that I was introduced to this program. And it was God who did it. You can tell by my Midwestern twang that I'm not a shy, retiring Southern belle, drinking my gin out of a teacup. I was born and brought up in Chicago, and I'm one of those damn Yankees. I haven't gone back north yet. Married a boy from South Georgia, a young man, I guess he was a boy when I first knew him. And his daddy was just absolutely appalled. I also was a former Catholic. I suffer from terminal Catholicism also. So I have two diseases. But I'm getting way ahead of myself. I did not start out as a little girl growing up dreaming dreams of what I wanted to be when I grew up. I certainly didn't want to become an alcoholic. My daddy was an alcoholic, and so I thought I knew what that was all about, and I didn't want any part of it. He didn't drink well. He got drunk, he passed out, and he was a traveling salesman. And it was pretty scary every time he went out, and I wondered if he'd be coming back. My mother was an untreated Al-Anon, and remained so. She decided that in my teenage years that she would join him. If she couldn't beat him, she would drink her own drinks. So in effect, I had two alcoholic parents. And I was, at the age of 13, decided that I was going to learn how to drink right. I'd show them. It was one of the first signs of alcoholism, except I didn't know what any signs were at the time. I took my first drink. I found a pint of my daddy's White Horse Scotch, and I took it up in the attic, which had been fitted out as a day room for me to get away. I was an only child. I had lots of reasons to get away. The sneakiness of it was the big part. I drank that whole pint. My first drink was a whole pint. I didn't get sick. I didn't pass out. I didn't black out. I thought it was wonderful. It was a magic because it made me who I thought I wanted to be. I knew that I could dance. I could talk to anybody. I became pretty. Everything was just wonderful. And so I finished that bottle and hid it where Daddy hid all his bottles. And I went to school the next day, and I told the kids, "Hey, I have found some wonderful stuff. Are anybody's parents going out of town next weekend?" I don't know how many people I've turned on to alcohol back then, and whether or not they have developed problems. I'm sure there were some of them that have. But I just thought it was wonderful, and I had a tremendous capacity. In fact, I used to brag about how much I could drink and not get drunk. And I really looked down on people who showed their liquor. I know several times that I had to drive a boy home and park him on his front doorstep and ring the doorbell and tell his mother that I would bring the car, or he could come get the car the next morning. He was too drunk to drive. And then I went to school and bragged on that. I was served at the age of 14 in bars. I have never been carded, which it was an advantage looking older then, but it isn't now. Someday I wish somebody would card me. But I think those days are behind me. As I say, I was an only child. I was given every opportunity to excel. I had the capacity to excel. I was a perfectionist. And because I set my goals so high that nobody could reach them, much less me, I was doomed to failure for a lot of things. I would start a project and I'd go hell-bent for election, and then I'd get tired of it and put it down. I have at least 25 sweaters that I started knitting that need sleeves, and I've lost interest in them. I also decided that I wanted to be a doctor, but that was kind of out of my reach. There was a perception of a gender dissatisfaction of women going into doctoring. My parents kind of poo-pooed that. My chemistry grade at the when I graduated from college was the final grade was a 23, so I don't think that the medical profession has missed me. Then I decided I was going to be a nurse, but all the girls that I had graduated from high school with had gone into three-year nursing schools, and they were already practicing, and I couldn't, with my pride, I couldn't go and become a freshman. So I dropped that idea. So the next thing to do, a lot of my friends were getting married and getting engaged, and so I thought that's what I should do. I got a job with a big company in Chicago and met a young man there whom I really didn't like. He had kind of a dorky personality. Well, he was very smitten with me, and we dated for a while, and he was from the north side of Chicago, which is the side. I lived on the south side, so he kind of looked down on me. And he offered me a big ring. So, of course, I said yes. Now, I will say this, that I did want to be a good wife, and I did want to have children, and I wanted to be a tremendous mother. Part of my perfectionism, I was going to be the best mother in the city of Chicago. This man was offered a territory in Omaha, Nebraska, the armpit of the South, the Midwest. So my whole trousseau was geared toward winter clothes. And 2 weeks before the wedding, he was transferred to Miami, Florida. And there we went. Now, I had gone to college in Miami, and I only went there 2 years. I hated the heat. I didn't like Miami. I vowed I'd never go back. And guess where we moved to? We moved to Miami. Never say never. I lived in Miami for the next 15 years in that marriage. I had decided that I did not want to have an only child. I got carried away with the project. I had five. Each one of them wishes they were an only child. At least they did in the years they were growing up. They're great friends now. They have left home. I've even made friends with them since they left home. They're wonderful kids. I took my motherhood very seriously. But here I was, married and an adult. And of course I was going to continue to drink. This is the social 70s. It was coming out of the 60s. No, that was in the 60s. And I wasn't going to do drugs like they were doing in the 60s, those hippies. But here I was just doing the legal drinking. Except I was drinking a quart a day. I had my first child and gained like 80 pounds because I believed in eating for two. And had terrible cravings and just indulged myself. And so when I got pregnant, at 17, well, there's 17 months difference between them. When I got pregnant with the second one, I said to the doctor, I don't want to be fat. And I said, I've got to lose weight. And he said, well, I'll give you some diet pills that you take 45 minutes before a meal. And he gave me those little orange Dexedrin pills that I was to take 45 minutes before a meal. And he gave me a prescription with a bottle full that was supposed to last me a month. Within a week, I was eating the whole bottle. And I ground my teeth out, and I talked a lot, but I had to clean this house in Miami. I was just going hell-bent for election. But the teeth grinding really got to me, so I figured, well, if I can get the scotch to temper that part. And man, that was a keen high. And I spent a lot of time trying to measure how many pills and how much scotch that was to get that same high, and I never found it again. This was before those drugs were put on the control list. So I had the second baby and carried her 9 months and ate all my vegetables. I was very conscientious about prenatal diet and took all my vitamins. But I was drinking a quart a day and taking Dexedrine. This child was born. She looked like a plucked chicken. She was the skinniest damn baby. And she was a startly baby. Every time she moved, she would scare herself to death. And she screamed a lot. And I called the doctor and I said, this is a terrible baby. She must have colic or something, you know. So he was giving her, Paragoric, thank you. And so she'd sleep. And I was taking a little Paragoric with her. And I was nursing her, so she was getting double doses of Paragoric. And she did sleep a lot. And I called the doctor and I said, you know, this kid's sleeping all the time. And he said, well, that's what you came in for. But then, you know, within another week, she just crashed, is what she did. She came down off the speed. And I was the kind of mother who dipped the pacifier in sugar and then in scotch, or scotch and then sugar, so they'd have something sweet and they wouldn't lose it very often. And nursing mothers were supposed to drink beer to increase their milk. Well, beer took a lot out of me because, I mean, you have to pee a lot. So there's as much liquor in a shot of booze as there is in a can of beer, and not quite so much volume. Besides, liquor's quicker. Here I am with these two kids, you know, one of whom is crying or sleeping all the time. And then I had a third baby, and then this baby was an absolute dream. She would just lay in the bassinet and smile. She was the happiest baby in the world. She did get the pacifier with the scotch and the sugar. I don't think that's why she was happy. She was just a happy kid. But it had worked so well, you know, and they do keep the pacifier in their mouth a long time. And then I didn't get pregnant right away. Well, this marriage was not real swift at this point either. When that mill child got into kindergarten, I became mother, the perfect mother, you know. I went over and volunteered to be the room mother for the kindergarten. And this is in a Catholic church, and Catholic churches have carnivals whereby they gain lots of money. And so, of course, being the room mother, my duty was to be the snow cone booth. And we went over several days before the carnival started to build the booth. The men were all building the booth. And I had got a bag of snow cone ice and got the syrup and all. And we were going to test it out. And there was some really good-looking guy that walked by. And his five kids went to school with my five kids. And he had a bottle of creme de menthe. And we had creme de menthe snow cones, and I fell madly in love. And there began a romance. Now, you know, I bet you're all thinking, oh boy, we're going to hear all kinds of sex things now. We didn't have time for that because we were both drinking. Drinking was the more important part. His idea of romance was to bring me a split of champagne when my husband was out of town. It was very romantic. We'd go to this one bar. And you know, you go into a bar in Miami, you come out of that bright sun like we have here in Georgia. It's about the same temperature, too. And you walk into the black, pitch black, and it takes you 20 minutes for your eyes to adjust. We danced. There was one bar that had a dance floor, and we danced. And I remember one afternoon, we were dancing, and we listened to a lot of sad country songs, as well as romantic string music. Jackie Gleason was a big one. Some of you aren't old enough to remember him playing music. And he said to me this afternoon, you know in that little white building that's behind this building? And I said, yeah. And he said, my wife goes to Al-Anon over there. I said, what in hell is Al-Anon? He says, well, she's trying to do something about my drinking. He said, maybe you and I ought to go to AA sometime. I said, yeah. What I knew about AA, you could put on the head of a pin. I kind of thought it was Skid Row bums and soup kitchens and donuts, maybe just donuts. But I really didn't know what it was. Daddy had gone to an AA meeting years and years before, and he came home drunker than ever. I suspect Daddy did that to get somebody off his back like Mama. So I really didn't know what AA was. I said, oh yeah, we'll go sometime. Well, to make a long story short, I got really just madly in love with this guy. I knew I was married to the wrong one. And this guy and I were going to leave our families, our 10 children, and we were going to run away together. And we decided to go to Key West. Well, now, if anybody followed us, we'd have to swim to Cuba. It really wasn't a well-thought-out plan. Well, he picked me up one afternoon. I left a note, and he'd left a note at his house. And kids were all in school, and we were going to run away. And we got in the car, and we drove to a bar to get ready for the trip, you understand? And I had a $5 bill, and he had a Gulf credit card. And that's all we had. Now, this great running away romance of the year wasn't going to go to Key West because we drank the $5 at this bar getting ready to go. I will say this about him. He kept my self-esteem from absolutely hitting bottom. He was just as alcoholic as I was, but he loved me dearly, and I loved him dearly. And it's because we understood each other. I never yelled at him when he got up and danced on bars, and his wife did. Poor thing, she needed Al-Anon. That's about all I could talk about him now, except that after I moved up here and found this fellowship, which I will tell you about. He called one time, and I told him I had joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard several months later that he had joined. I hope he is still sober. We both needed this program, and by the grace of God and his wife, we got here. And anyway, I left Miami after the divorce. I did get a divorce that was very messy, cantankerous, horrible divorce. I agreed to let my oldest son go with his father, and I had the remaining four children come with me. And there was a lot of horrible feelings about that whole thing. But the four kids and I sold my house and took off. I wanted to live in Atlanta because this love of mine, and I always talked about coming to Atlanta and buying a house on a hill and get an Irish setter dog, and we were going to live happily ever after. We didn't talk about picket fences, but it was high on a hill, and I guess you don't need a fence like that. So I came to Atlanta to follow my geographical dream and bought a house on a hill, got an Irish setter, went to the grocery store before the moving truck got there. I mean, I wasn't going to the grocery store, but that's what I told the kids. Kids were having fun. I had told them I'd bought a one-story house, and it turns out it was three stories. And they had fun. They were running up and down stairs. They had never seen stairs. And I said I was going to the grocery store. Well, I headed out. We lived here in Dunwoody, and just not far from 285. And I had not lost my sense of direction. Excuse me. But 285 absolutely drove me crazy because it would say I'd be going north, and it would say 285 west. I'd be going south, it would say 285 east. 285 is 60 miles around. I've been around it many times. It's exactly 60 miles. I'd wake up in the middle of the night and I think, what if these kids had an accident and I had to get them to the emergency room? So I would get in the car and I would go look for a hospital. Well, I found lots of hospitals, but where they were in relation to the house, I have no idea. But they were off of 285. The only liquor store I found was in Sandy Springs. This real estate woman, whom I took a tremendous resentment against, had sold me a house in a dry county, DeKalb County. DeKalb County was dry. Now, I had already heard that you couldn't drink on Sunday, and I thought that was pretty narrow-minded. But a dry county, you can't buy anything in the county you live in, was the most backward place I'd ever thought I'd landed. But I did find this liquor store up in Sandy Springs, again, not knowing how to get back home. And I went in there. Women, I don't know, you guys don't have a hard time with liquor stores, but this woman did. I used to feel like I had to explain. And I explained to this man standing behind the counter that I had just moved here and I was going to have a party. Well, when you're going to have a party, you buy scotch and gin and bourbon and mixers, and some people like theirs with mixers. Buy a couple bags of ice, things like that. Well, I went in, and the first thing that got to me was the prices. I mean, in Miami, you could drink on Election Day, you could drink on Sunday, you could drink standing on your head if you wanted to. And every Thursday in the paper with the grocery ads, they had liquor store ads. $4.95 a quart. And now here I've been drinking a quart a day. I walked into this liquor store and there's this huge bottle. It was a half gallon. It was the biggest damn thing I'd ever seen. And I thought this is wonderful. I won't have to find this liquor store as often. But it was like something like $10.95 or something. It was very expensive. So I gathered some in each arm. Somebody had left a grocery cart there, so I filled it all up. But it was all green striped vodka. It was the cheapest vodka they had. It's made from citrus peelings. I wouldn't recommend it. It's pretty hard to get down and keep it to stay down. But I discovered that right away. So I went that day from drinking a quart a day to a half gallon a day, and it didn't take me long to go downhill. I went to work every morning, and I had discovered that if you put a quart bottle, I always had a big purse. If you put a quart bottle in the purse and...
Get the microphone.
Oh, I'm sorry. If you put a quart bottle in your purse and you have to walk fast, it gurgles. But there's a solution. You get a bunch of medicine bottles, and you fill them up, and then you put cigarette packs and bunches of Kleenex in between them so they don't clank together. And you can walk real fast and nothing happens. My job at the time was working in a collection agency. I never collected a dime for those people because I felt sorry for everybody on the other end of the line. I harassed no one. In fact, they fired me 3 months after I got sober for being overqualified for the job, because what had taken me all day to do, I was able to do in an hour. didn't collect any money from them then either. I was not a good collection agency person. But I go to work, and you know the traffic. And I was working in Buckhead, because that's a wet county. I discovered that. I only went on job interviews in wet counties. I would have to have a glass of something, and I always bought split seat cars. Never bench seats. They always had split seats. So I could tuck that in there because the traffic, you know, it's terrible, and you just need things to calm your nerves if you're going to drive in Atlanta. And I would drink a great big glass full of vodka, believing that nobody could smell vodka. You understand? Smirnoff was very popular at the time, and they always said it left you breathless, and I believed them. Of course, prior to getting up to go to work, I would have to drink a couple of old-fashioned glasses full in order to keep one down, in order to get out of bed. I got so that I couldn't brush my back teeth because I would gag. I would fill my medicine bottles. I would put a quart in the trunk for the afternoon, and I would go to work, and I'd drink on the way to work, and I'd get to work, and I'd make a big production of going to buy a tab. The tab was popular at the time. My sobriety date is June 3rd, 1972, and those of you who can remember back then, tabs were it. Because I was always weight conscious, if you realize. Hadn't eaten in 20 years, but that's beside the point. I would make the big production of getting a tab, and I'd pour it in the glass, and then I'd get down under the desk, and I would get the medicine bottle out, and I would fill it up. There was that much tab and that much vodka. And I would drink all morning, and then folks at work would say, well, would you like to go out for lunch? Well, they ate lunch. I didn't eat lunch. So I never made any friends at that collection agency, nor did I please my bosses. I would go to a bar and have a couple of martinis, and then I would fill my medicine bottles and the quart out of the trunk, and I would go back to work, make another production of getting a tab. And I would work all afternoon, and then because it was a wet county, I had to get supplies for tomorrow, for tonight and tomorrow, and I'd stop at the liquor store. I had to write my check in the car because if anybody was watching me, my hand would go crazy. All of this that came from that first magic, look at where it is today. We all drank to feel better, and I did. I felt better for a long number of years when I was drinking. But then it turned on me, and it got so that I couldn't write a check because my hand would go scratchy. I still have some of those checks, and I don't believe that the bank should have cashed any of them. Every one of them is endorsed by a liquor store. Every one of them. I would come home with my fresh supply, and I would yell at the kids. I mean, here I had been out working for them all day, and they were tearing up the house. Nobody had supper started. Of course, nobody had asked them to make supper either. So I would just yell at this oldest daughter, and she turned out to be a darn good cook. But it wasn't my doing. It wasn't because Mother... daughter has come to haunt me. It wasn't because Mother was in the kitchen teaching her how to cook. It was I was yelling instructions over the phone for more. Then I would also make her make sure that the other kids' homework was done. She became the mother, and I forced it on her. Well, things are getting pretty bad. Now, my youngest one, they called me from nursery school and said that they thought he might have a problem because he wouldn't take a nap out on the floor on his mat with the other kids. He wanted to sleep in the closet, and all of his pictures were black. I can't imagine why this kid would have a problem. I mean, this messy divorce, moving up here, and on the move, I'd brought four marijuana cigarettes, because I'd never tried marijuana, and whoever gave them to me told me that, you know, don't drink, so you get the real effect of the marijuana. And I put them in an envelope and put them in my purse, because I get up in the morning and I drink. And so tomorrow I was going to try the marijuana. It was always tomorrow. I quit tomorrow. Title of a good book. Kids were terrified that I was going to get busted for this marijuana. I had an open container all the way from Miami to Atlanta. But they weren't as afraid of that. That was something they recognized. But they were afraid of the marijuana. I can stand here and tell you I never did try those marijuana. They kind of crumpled up in the little paper in the envelope. And I never could stop drinking long enough to taste it and see whether I liked it high or not, so I ended up throwing the little leaves away. But everything was getting so hard. I tried to keep the secret, try to be the woman, the divorced woman in the neighborhood who was doing everything right. You know, the persona I wanted to... things weren't going well at work. I had no personal life. I had no money, very little. And things had to happen. So because I was doing this persona of taking my kids to church, I happened to look at the bulletin, the church bulletin, one Sunday. And this was during a service where, midway through the service, my youngest son would hold up his hand, and I would drag him out like he had to go to the bathroom so I could have a drink. I couldn't make it through the whole service. And that was part of his church service, was halfway through. Mom. But I happened to read the church bulletin. It said, AA meets here on Saturday night. I had gone to St. Jude's Church here in Sandy Springs, because I had done novenas to St. Jude, who was the patron saint of hopeless cases. His boyfriend and I had made many novenas to St. Jude, and nothing seemed to be happening. And I used to say, I don't know what made me read that bulletin. Today I can very definitely say that God was leading me and was doing for me what I could not do for myself. He put my eyes on that bulletin, and I decided I would go to that meeting, even if the Skid Row bums were there. So I worked all week, and I remember coming down on Saturday night, and the kids were all sitting around the table, eating supper and getting ready to do their homework, and this look of fear, because I used to go to a piano bar up on Roswell Road in 285, and every time I went out the door, they weren't sure that I would come back. I wasn't sure I was going to come back either. And they had this look of fear, like, and my daughter said, are you going to your piano bar? And I said, no, I'm going to a meeting if it's any of your damn business. Nice, gentle mother. This is the perfect mother that I wanted to be, right? So I'm kind of telling you a story of somebody else. I became somebody else because I didn't really know who I was. So I went and I drove to that church, St. Jude's, And the parking lot was dark. And there were several cars there. The library was open and the lights were on. It was in June. It was just before Memorial Day, as a matter of fact. And it was hot. And I got that half gallon. Now, see, I had not learned, you know, they put that little ball in the half gallon bottle so that it doesn't spill out real fast when you pour it. It kind of goes glug, glug, glug. Well, I didn't know you could take that little ball out. And so I got down in the car like this, and I get that big bottle. And you got, you know, trying to get down here below the window so nobody can see you tip up your head and wait for the glug, glug, glug. That's a hell of a way to drink. But I did that, and I walked across that parking lot, and it was the longest walk I've ever taken. And I thought, well, the kids, they must be having a youth group or something over there, because these people were laughing in this lighted room. And I just knew that no Alcoholics Anonymous meeting would have any laughter in it, no matter what they did. So I walked over there, and I was going to go right by this room looking for the AA meeting in another room that was dark and quiet. And this guy is standing there like this. He looked like my ex-husband, so I hated him on sight. And he was a finger pointer, and I'd bitten my husband's finger off one time for doing that to me. And he says, come on in, you're in the right place. He could smell the vodka from the parking lot. And of course, I immediately got a resentment, you know, how dare he? What does he know about me? I'm a fine, upstanding Dunwoody woman, right? Slumming in Sandy Springs. I went into the meeting and I sat down and I was nervous. Good God. I had tractors in my stomach. I didn't have butterflies. These tractors, you know, rumble, rumble, rumble. And they were rumbling, and it was a speaker's meeting, and this guy just wouldn't leave me alone. He was right there. And he did ask me before the meeting started how much I drank. And for the first time, I told the truth. And he turned sheet white, and he said, oh, honey, you need medical help. He said, I know a doctor who is an alcoholic and a drug addict. And I thought, oh, my God, they ought to put this guy away. He wants me to go see a doc. He says, this doctor treats alcoholics after hours. Well, I knew about men who treated women after hours. But he wanted me to go see this guy with a 4-day growth of beard and a bottle on his desk and a syringe hanging out his arm. And that was going to help, right? So I thought he was crazy. And he told me the doctor's name and told me that he'd be glad to see me. And I couldn't get away from this guy fast enough. So we sat down. It was a speaker's meeting. And the guy got up and he talked about the first part of his story, about his drinking. And boy, I was with him all the way. I recognized everything he said. And then he said he went to AA and then he lost me because everything turned just wonderful. He quit drinking and his wife came back and his cars got bigger and, bullshit. I wasn't sure about that at all. But anyway, about now, and he kept talking and talking, and first they had done all those 12 God things, and I didn't want to hear anything about God. Thank you very much. God and I had parted company some time ago. Part of my terminal Catholicism, I was guilty from the day I was born. And I was going to burn in hell forever, you know, so I didn't want to hear about God. And the beads of sweater now beginning to pop out of my head, and I needed to get to the car and get me another glug, glug, glug. And everybody's clapping. The guy finally got through talking about how pitch keen everything was. And I'm trying to duck out the back door because I was sitting right behind the back door, and this guy clamps his hand on me and said, stay just a little bit longer. We're going to have a birthday party. And I thought, oh, my God, cake and ice cream and balloons and I'd given lots of kids birthday parties, and I knew in ponies, maybe, who knows? What that had to do with alcohol, I don't know, but I sure didn't want to stay for any dessert. Thank you, but he clapped his hand on my arm. And this was John Gibbons. I don't know how many of you remember him. He's dead now, so I can use his last name. And I hated him. Oh, my God, he was interfering with my life. And anyway, we were all standing around this table. There was a cake on the table, and it had a great big 23 on it. And so I'm looking around looking for the 23-year-old. I was going to go rub pelvises. I like boys. And everybody's singing except this one silver-haired man, and he was kind of smiling and accepting this birthday song. And I thought, if that guy is only 23 years old, I didn't understand that we speak in the present tense and that we celebrate AA birthdays, not belly button birthdays. He was 48 when he died, and he used to love to hear me tell that story. He was a sweet old man, and he had a lot to do with my sobriety, because he was a very good man. But anyway, the folks did, even this guy that I didn't like, told me to come back. The guy that I didn't like kept telling me that there's something about men and women and women. Well, I didn't want to hear that because I hated women. Women talked about, they would get a glass with liquor in it, and then they'd let the beads form on the outside. The ice would melt. They'd put it down somewhere and never pick it up again. And what a waste. I mean, these people were stupid. Women were stupid. And then they'd sit around and they'd talk about dirty diapers and soap powders. Shoot, that's what I was away from the house from. I didn't want to sit there and talk about it. But their husbands were in the kitchen where the liquor was, so guess where I spent my time. Those women didn't like me any better than I liked them either, because I was out in the kitchen drinking liquor and rubbing pelvises with their husbands. I was having a good time, I thought. But see, that's a different Natalie. The Natalie that I know today got to Alcoholics Anonymous and went back after that first birthday meeting. And I kept going back because the same guy, John Gibbons, would tell me where the next meeting was. Well, that was on a Saturday night. On the following Thursday night, I take that back. The following Saturday, I went to see this doctor. And do you know what? He didn't have a four-day growth of beard. He didn't have a bottle in evidence. There was no needle marks. He was pressed, suit, clear-eyed, and he put his arms around me and said, "You can get better, too." And I had needed to be held for so long because I was holding all this, trying to pull myself up by my bootstraps like I'd been taught. And it was all falling down inside. And this man seemed to understand. He told me about himself, that he had been in the DTs and had been in a hospital where they strapped him down and they talked nasty to him. And he said it was his hope, his dream, to build a hospital where the alcoholic could be treated with love and dignity and good medical care. And as sick as I was, I said, "If you ever build that hospital, I want to go there and work with you." He did, and I did, and that's a whole other story that I won't go into right now. But I did go back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and on a Thursday night after I had seen this doctor, who did let me withdraw, he got so, and he gave me medication so that I didn't have convulsions, but I withdrew. I used to sit there waiting for my nurse, and the tractors picked up some tractor trailer trucks, and they were rumbling. I think we were having drag races in this. Oh, it was horrible. I know I can drink again, but I'm sure I can't go get sober again. I wouldn't go through that again for anything. But it was necessary for me, and the God who understands me knew that. I had to come in off the street. I couldn't come in through treatment. I had to come in off the street, and I had to do it the hard way. because I'm a hard-headed, doubting Thomas. I kept going back to meetings, and I kept hearing things that made sense. I would leave the church, and I would drive. I'd say, I can take anything for the next 5 minutes. Then I'll have a drink. And then 5 minutes would go up, and I'd say, all right, well, I'll have a drink in the next 5 minutes. And I couldn't do it 24 hours at a time. It was literally 5 minutes at a time, waiting for my nerve ends to come through my skin. They didn't come through my skin, and I did make a few until finally it was 24 hours. By God, that was the first time in 25 years that I had been able to go one day without a drink. If my eyes were open, I was drinking until that time. On the following Thursday night, the same doctor had told me the group that he had gone to was a Decatur group, now called the Decatur Square Group, and that they had homemade goodies. Now, desserts started to appeal to me. There's a strong correlation with alcoholism and sugar. And he said it was a good group of people and that they would help me not drink. So I went this Thursday, and the first Thursday night, to the Decatur group. And I don't remember whether it was, I think it was a speaker's meeting. Yes, it was a speaker's meeting. But anyway, I listened. I don't know that I got anything out of it. I don't remember that I got anything out of it. I've always gotten something out of an AA meeting. But I don't specifically remember what it was tonight. But after the meeting, they had homemade brownies. By God, I was one of the first ones back to the table. I gained 40 pounds when I got here in about 3 weeks. I did like that group because they took turns bringing goodies. Anyway, there was a man standing back there in the corner minding his own business, eating his brownie. And I had this vision, this hindsight vision, that I backed him literally into a corner. I have to tell you what I looked like. Glenn could tell you better, but I have heard his story often enough that I like to let you know. Now, you know I came from Miami, and I still had my Miami thing. And women's hair gets drunk, and I had bought a long blonde fall. My hair was kind of this color. And the velvet band started here. I paid $100 for that human hair fall. I mean, it was top class. And I'd plunk it on there, sometimes straight, sometimes crooked. This was in the days of mini skirts and hot pants, go-go white boots. And I also had my sparkly Miami sunglasses, the cat's eyes with the diamonds. You know, little sparkly things on the side. And this, I'm going into an AA meeting, and I know darn well all the men are going to be glad I joined. The part that Glenn tells that I don't like to tell is that I also had a liver belly. I did have a liver belly, but I thought I was hot stuff anyway. And there were nothing but a bunch of old farts in there. They weren't terribly impressed with my go-go boots and my miniskirt and hot pants. And this fellow was just minding his business, and I backed him into the corner, and I started asking him questions. And he told me he had been to Willing Way, and that if he was willing, there was a way, and the way was Alcoholics Anonymous, and that in treatment there, he had learned a lot about Alcoholics Anonymous and what the steps meant and how you work them. And he had been sober 6 months. 6 months! I mean, it might as well have been 600 years to me. I thought that was fantastic. So, I have found a friend. And you see, I wouldn't tell you in a meeting that I didn't understand what you were talking about. I just let on like I did. You know, that's part of my alcoholism. But after the meeting, I'd get him and I'd say, what did they mean about the sixth step? And he would give me his great wisdom from that he had learned at Willing Way. It was kind of cute, too. Anyway, we became good friends, and we started going to meetings together, mainly so I could ask him these questions that I couldn't ask y'all. And the first time I heard, "The first drink gets you drunk," absolutely, you know, tore through me. I could not get that through my head. Glenn explained it to me. But anyway, he came over and he fixed the kids' bikes, and they were just enthralled with him. He was helping me stay sober. He would like me to say that he's my higher power. I will not say that. He is not my higher power. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous is my higher power. And that was the only way I could accept God, was God was talking to me through you people. You said things that made sense to me, and they were painless, almost painless. My higher power has spoken. I want the bank over here. I'm afraid to touch it, it'll squeal. I'm not going to talk much longer. You've heard most of me. Thank you, Dick. The higher power to me was the group of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. You were doing what I couldn't do for myself, and you were showing me how to do it by your example, your caring, your sharing. And to me, that is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You taught me how to work the steps. From them, I gained the principles that is the base of this program. And I have so much gratitude that I could go on for 2 hours about that, but I won't do that to you. I have a great deal of gratitude. The children that came with me absolutely adore this man. The child who did not come to Atlanta with me did eventually move to Atlanta with his business and his wife and his two daughters. And we have a relationship. He went to my 20th. I invited him to my 20th AA birthday so that he could see what Alcoholics Anonymous was about, because when I first got sober, I tried to make an amends to him, and he thought that it being a disease was a cop-out. And today, with 28 years of sobriety, I think he's changed his mind. He also saw at that meeting when I celebrated my 20th birthday that we are just folks. We are folks who understand each other and who love each other, and that the bullshit doesn't have to be here. The other four children, as I say, had a father. They got a father when Glenn and I were married. We were good friends first. We fell in love. And we got married after I'd been sober a year. The higher power over here decreed that I had to wait a year. And everybody thought that it probably wouldn't last. And it may not. And that's really his line. I stole his line. But we've been married 27 years. As I say, the other four children found a dad that they didn't know they had. They love him. Every one of the girls got married asked Dad to walk them down the aisle, even though their biological father is living. He has alienated all his children, and that's okay, too. This man loves those children. They are his children. His mom and daddy took them in and made no distinction among the grandchildren. They were the grandchildren. As I said before, Glenn's daddy, being from South Georgia, wasn't too sure about this Yankee who was a former Catholic coming into the family, but he learned to love me. And I think respected me. And he was certainly grateful. He and Mama were grateful that Glenn had the opportunity to raise a family. And I am certainly grateful that Glenn had the opportunity. Those children learned a lot. I see, I was one of those alcoholic mothers who threatened a lot but never followed through. They had absolutely no discipline, didn't know what it was until he came on the scene. And They are all wonderful children today. To my knowledge, none of them has a drinking problem. In fact, when they were in high school, they used to ask me to come over in front of their peers and talk about alcoholism, knowing that I would say that I am an alcoholic. The first PTA meeting I went to right after I got into this program, I used to have to practice saying my name is Natalie and I'm an alcoholic. I went to a PTA meeting and everybody went around the room and gave their name. And guess what I said? And the whole room got quiet. That's right over here at the school. And but after the meeting, I bet you 25 people came up to me, said, my mother is, my father is, my aunt. What did you do? How did you do it? You know, that whole thing. So I have no anonymity in Dunway. And my kids didn't have any either. But they were not embarrassed. And to me, that is quite a compliment to have some teenagers ask you to speak to their peers about your alcoholism. Tonight, we are hoping that our youngest daughter is going to have her second baby. She's ready. I don't know that she started into labor yet or not, but she was at the doctor today, and they said momentarily. So this will be our eighth grandchild. And granddaddy, is a granddaddy to all of them, too. I would not have any of this if it hadn't been for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I hear someone talk about a gratitude list, I need a whole notebook. At first, I couldn't be grateful for anything because my life was, in my opinion, such a mess and totally unmanageable. Although I wouldn't accept the fact that it was unmanageable, having been brought up to bring yourself up by your bootstraps. My life was totally unmanageable. And this program and you people showed me how to trudge the road to happy destiny. And I'm ever so grateful. And I again thank you all for inviting me to open up this weekend. And I know you're all going to have a great weekend. Thank you very much.